Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Just Another Kill Team Podcast, connecting Kill Team communities across the globe. This week, we are chatting with Paul in Japan. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Paul. You know, we're excited to come finally get to Japan. You know, we were trying and struggling to get a hold of David, who was the original TO for the Japanese scene. But sounds like life has gotten a little bit busy. So Paul has graciously decided to step in and share some Void Dancer tips with us.
Yeah, looking forward to it, guys.
Yeah. You know, Japan's always got a ton in popular media, especially with the rise of anime. And, you know, I think Tao were originally slated as like a faction for the Japanese region on some levels. So it'd be cool to hear us to hear a little bit from the Japanese scene.
Yeah, totally. I guess the Gunpla thing is like the most like analogous thing to Tao here. So, yeah, totally.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for my part, I use a fair number of Tamiya products, you know, between the God Hand and the extra thin plastic cement. Those things are extremely helpful and much better, I think, than the GW products. I don't really know what it's like in Japan.
Have you used the God Hand stuff? Because, like, I mean, they're expensive, right? But, like, is it really, like, a lot better than the, like, regular clippers? Like, what do you think?
I do think they're pretty nice. They're definitely better than, like, generic like home tool clippers, which I've used, because those dull pretty fast. The God Hands have stayed pretty sharp, and I've had them for a while, so I like them.
I have a pair of Tamiya clippers, and those are really good. Just like regular, super sharp, and yeah, they do the job. They're not like they're the same price as the GW one, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah. What have you been up to in your day-to-day life, Paul? You know, we talked a little bit before this about, you know, how you got into Japan, but I'm sure listeners will be kind of curious about how you got into Warhammer in the Japanese scene.
So I guess like a lot of people who played 40K when they were younger, and then sort of they started working and studies and stuff, and like they got really busy, and then I played from basically early second edition to into third edition 40K, and then took a huge break, and then really just sort of started getting interested in like during COVID when we were sort of all locked down, and I sort of started watching YouTube videos and stuff like that, and then just basically went to my local Games Workshop and luckily bumped into David. He was just in the store at the same time. And then things just went from there and got into Kill Team that way.
Nice. I mean, Kill Team has definitely been a big part of, you know, me and Jason's life, obviously, with we've got this podcast and all this other stuff. How many people play in the Japanese scene?
So I think at the moment we've got maybe, I want to say, 20 regulars. And there are like maybe another sort of maybe like 30 in total of people who sort of who have played, and we are sort of slow. We're obviously a much smaller scene, I think, than some of the other guests you've had on to talk about, and we are sort of slowly bringing people into the hobby. We've got like Wargamers in Japan Discord that we started this year. And that's been a really good source of getting people connected with the group. And we've had a few new players coming in through that way as well. So it's a bit smaller. And our events are generally smaller. We have like a place where we play that kind of caps out at the capacity of about 12. Although we did run a larger event at the... Do you know the Warhammer Cafe in Tokyo? In Akihabara? They opened it, I think, a year ago. Just over a year ago. And that's a much bigger place. And we had like a 16-player tournament there one time that was really cool. And we hope to try to do sort of similar things again next year and get bigger.
That sounds really cool. I actually have not heard about any of the GW stuff going on in Japan. Feels like a world away as far as New York is concerned.
Yeah.
But speaking of, Discords, we've got our own Discord in case, afterwards, you'll join up and that way you can talk to some other people outside of the Japanese scene. Maybe forward some people along if anyone visits any of the many places we've been to on this Discord.
Yeah, totally. Didn't mean to sort of shill my Discord ahead of yours. Sorry, guys.
No, it's good. It's good. I think it's a really important part to make sure that you push all of your social media channels to build up your scene. You know, when you're new and you've got a small Discord, make sure that people know about it. It's definitely something that helped in New York. I'm sure Jason's had similar experiences.
Yeah, the Discord has been huge for keeping everything organized and looking good. And if you want, we can throw a link to your Discord in the podcast description, and you'll find our link there as well.
That would actually be really great, guys. Yeah, we'd super appreciate that. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I think actually one of my friends from New York, when he came to Japan, I sent him along to David to try to see if he could line up a game, and I think he just barely missed one of the tournaments.
Yeah, we've had a couple of people from the UK scene who've been like here on holiday, and one of them was able to join one of the events through that way. I think it has been really good because like previously we had Line. It's like the messaging app that everyone uses in Japan.
Yeah.
So we had Line groups, but obviously if you're a tourist, you'd have no way of finding this, right? So getting connected to that is like you have to come in store, and then the store manager would say, hey, you can join this Line group, right? That's how we did things before Discord. And so that's worked for you, right? So with the New York scene, like that's really been useful, I guess.
Yeah, we use Discord at the shops. We have 4 or 5 different shops at this point that all have independent communities, but because everyone's on Discord, when something is happening, we're able to share across things pretty easily. I guess obviously in a lot of different regions, people have different messaging apps. But Discord has currently become kind of like the default home for gamers over a long period of time. And I think Peru, they use WhatsApp. I think in London, they use Discord. In Poland, they use Facebook. But everyone at some point touches Discord nowadays.
Yeah. I guess it makes sense. Yeah.
One of the fun things that someone else in our local club did was they actually made a bunch of like little posters, and it's on printer paper, and it's just like a little like intro to Kill Team thing. There's a QR code on there, and it's like, are you interested in Kill Team? Like, show up to one of these game nights. You don't need to bring anything, and then here's a QR code, and that brought them to the Discord server. And I don't know if we've gotten a lot of people that have scanned it, but it's a cool concept, and we've got a steady flow of people coming in, and I don't know where they all come from. So I'd like to think there's at least a portion of them that are just like finding the QR codes in game stores and joining because of it.
Okay, we might steal that idea. Sorry. Thank you.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Oh, cool.
So you guys have a couple different stores, one on the smaller side with 12 person cap, and then Akihabara.
Yeah, that's right.
is like the, I know there's like a Magic the Gathering store that was really big out there before, but it's like what, where your new shop is?
Yeah, so the place we have our events is a sort of, I guess it's like it's not a store. They do sell some stuff, but it's like a gaming club. And it's sort of privately run. There are a couple of stores, like there's like the main stores that we're sort of associated with are, sorry, we have a store in Harajuku, which is a really popular tourist area, and then the store in Yokohama. So like the managers there, Daniel and Yuka, are really good at connecting people and like running intro games for new customers and getting them into Kill Team that way. And then they kind of like refer them to us if they want to play more. And then the place where we play the sort of the local gaming club is called Emule, and it's in Yokohama. So that's actually kind of a little bit south of Tokyo. And the manager there, Yutaka, he sort of lets us basically reserve the entire place for like events and stuff. So it's really cool. And he also serves like really nice whiskey and beer. So it's a really cool place to just sit and game. Yeah.
I mean, talking about that, you know, Japan has got this crazy nightlife, like gamer culture, otaku culture. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what a normal tournament day is like in Japan. Because I know that, you know, in New York, we like run a tournament and then everyone kind of like splits off. But I'm sure there's got to be some nightlife that maybe is a little bit more unique to Japan that you can talk up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, sort of what we kind of do is we will play a round or two rounds, depending on how quick we can get through those games in the morning. And then we'll go for lunch at a pizza place. And they have really nice, sorry, I'm a ham and pineapple pizza guy. So, but they have really nice pizzas there, nice pizza oven. And afterwards, when we finished, we'll go to like Izakiya, like a Japanese style pub, and we'll have like fried chicken wings and all sorts of like tofu and gyoza. It's yeah, it's nice. And sometimes we'll go for karaoke afterwards, but that takes a bit more time. And some people, because we often play on Sundays, it's kind of late if we do that. So that's only occasionally.
Sounds like a very tight knit group if you're able to do karaoke after the tournament.
Yeah, no, it's cool. Yeah, like we've got a few characters in the group. It's very kind of international. We do have a couple of Japanese players in the group, and it's we're obviously trying to get more Japanese players involved in the community, especially in it's easier in the bigger 40K to do that because it's it seems to be more popular. A Kill Team seems to be a sort of a more like it's not as well known, I think, in the Japanese community. Generally, they all sort of like to collect sort of the bigger 40K armies because the hobby scene here, like the painting and the hobby stuff, is really big. So people like to have projects to work on, I think.
Yeah, that is a pretty universally true thing with like the current version of Kill Team is like a newer thing, and like it's pretty much on the rise everywhere. So it's a perfectly normal thing to expect, and it has been really cool to see it grow, and just like it is popping up like all over the world and little groups here and there, and all the groups just kind of keep on growing and more keep popping up. So that's a great trend. Always glad to see that and hear about it.
Yeah, like, well, I guess one of the things we sort of, the challenges we face sometimes is because we obviously, most of us don't have good Japanese skills. So if we want to play with Japanese players, they'll have their rules in Japanese and we'll have ours in English. And sometimes the translations are not good. Sometimes the translations don't get the rules right. I think the Spanish scene also has this issue sometimes, right?
This came up at the World Championships, where I think the Spanish translation of Ceaseless and Relentless are very, very close, or even the same word.
All right.
So, yeah, which is, you know, there's a lot of translation issues. And obviously, they're an English-speaking company, so that's where all the rules are centralized. So everyone kind of has different speaking problems.
Yeah, I guess except for the, what was it, the Justinian team, the heavy bolter, right? The Japanese one?
You guys got the correct bolter profile with 5 attacks.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear that there's translation issues. So not everyone in the scene is speaking Japanese, obviously. It sounds like a pretty hodgepodge mix of people, which just sounds very cool.
Yeah, no, it's it's pretty cool. So we have, like I said, it's fairly international. We have sort of a lot of people from Europe, a bunch of people from the US. We've had, we have the Japanese players. I think we had someone from Australia one time. Maybe even someone from South America, but I forget now. Sorry, I apologize to them for that. But and we had an Italian player come in recently whose English is not great, but he was able to, you know, get along and play as well. So it was cool. I guess it helps that the game has lots of keywords, right? So you can kind of get around like that.
You can point to the same portion of the rule book, even though the translations aren't the same, and kind of muddle your way through it, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it kind of works in a way, yeah.
But the team you're playing is probably got to be one of the harder ones for this to work, right? Since you play Void Dancer Troop?
Right. So if I'm doing like an intro game with somebody, I will like not use some, I will not use most of the tricks the team can do because it's quite frustrating to play against. I don't know, maybe this seems to be a recurring feature when people talk about Void Dancers is they're not pleasant to play against. And for a while I switched to Hand of the Archon just to make things a little bit more similar to other teams, especially for newer players. I personally really, really enjoy playing Void Dancers. I love not having to worry about movement, and I can be fairly relaxed about deployment because I don't have to worry about moving around my own operatives. And also don't have to, like, for a long time, I didn't really have to worry about climbing or traversing, which was kind of nice, right? You just ignore whole sections of the rulebook.
Yeah, you ignore whole sections and force your opponent to also ignore entire sections of the rulebook, which can be a very frustrating experience when people are trying to learn a game, yeah. But in tournament play, it's all fair game.
I think so, yeah. And it's been interesting that there were no Void Dancers at the World Championships recently. I was sort of wondering, like, do you guys have ideas? Like, maybe at the top level, that Void Dancers just don't quite have enough to compete? Or is that just more what players are interested in?
I think it's pretty hard for Void Dancers to compete at the top level. The matchup spread has not been particularly kind to them, where Commandos have always been a somewhat not easy matchup, because every Commando can beat a player in one-on-one combat, and they have 10 operatives, and now they have 11.
Yeah.
And then coupled with, you know, Just a Scratch and the continual layers of buffs that Commandos have gotten, Void Dancers really struggle when the best team just kind of beats them, not automatically, but at a very high level when everyone knows everything. Void Dancers don't have nearly the same level of power as they do in newer levels of play.
Yeah, totally. And I kind of feel like it's moved a little bit more towards, or at least this is from what I've seen, it's moved towards more Horde teams being sort of the competitive, or larger teams, certainly away from elites. And I think Void Dancers are really good into elites. Generally, I think any team you out-activate, you have a big, big advantage against. But being out-activated against yourself is kind of tough. And I think a lot of the good players, I mean, I play a bit on TTS as well. And whenever I've come up against, you know, like these high-ranking players, it's always they're very good with like keeping their fret pieces till last, and then just having this huge fret that I have to play around, and it becomes really tough.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk a little bit about it in the Operative Showdown today, right, Jason?
Operative Showdown! Yeah.
The Operative Showdown today, on that note, is, of course, Void Dancers, and we will be comparing kind of the two big, like, shining operatives, the HQ units in 40K. We've got the Death Jester and the Shadow Seer, and just kind of, like, comparing and contrast their strengths and weaknesses, looking for any cool plays, especially, like, the Shadow Seer's got a lot of cool tools that I don't see a lot of people talking about.
Yeah, I mean, these are basically, like, the two special operatives on the team, right? I think the lead player has a special ability, but it doesn't really interact with the game. It's something that you use in the strategic phase. So really, it's the Death Jester and the Shadow Seer, right? And Death Jester is kind of just a space marine with a suspensor, right, that can fly. So they don't, and they also have, like, effectively a heavy bolter. But they do have Reap, too, which catches people out sometimes, right? And I'm always watching for it. If I can charge with the Death Jester and kill someone next to their friend with just two wounds, it's nice, right? And if you had Murderous Entrance, you can kill like a guardsman and then, you know, kill their friend automatically with two wounds left, and then you can shoot. It's kind of nice. But I think the Shadow Seer probably takes it for utility. Like, she has a really nice mortal wound spell, which is like the only other long range shooting that we've got. And I like to use this to chip down operatives to like another wound bracket, right? So if I'm into commandos, it's great for taking those 10 wound commandos down to 7, and now I can one-shot them with a kiss. Or if I'm against maybe like marines, you can take like 3 wounds off them. You take them now, you can kill them in 2 hits, right? I can get them down to 9 wounds. It's real nice. she's also really good for protecting my players from being charged. I can like play, I think it's Fog of Dreams or Veil of Tears. I always get the two mixed up, but effectively one of them does a denial of a charge unless you started your activation within 6. And it also gives you cover, so even if you're on top of a vantage and there's no, it's like an empty vantage point, you can still have cover there if you're concealed, and you effectively can't be shot, which is really nice for getting a vantage on the TAC Ops. Mm-hmm. And The other one, the delay activation, is kind of fun because you can obviously, it's not like the, it's not as good as the Phobos one where you pick it at the start of the turn. This one is actually an action that you do, but it does really help for, okay, so you can create traffic jams. So like, say your opponent has like their players lined up against a wall and there's someone at the end of the wall, right? If you pick this person, now they have to move around them, right? They wanted to move that person first. Well, now they can lose a few inches getting around this guy at the end of the wall. So that's kind of fun. You can also obviously just pick whoever your opponent wanted to activate first and stop them, which is really cool. So the Shadow Seer, I think, has a lot of utility. She's also not bad in combat. She still has 4-5 damage. Only has 4 attack dice, but I have killed a Phobos Marine, like, from full health down to 0 with her. We just rolled all 4 hits. It was super lucky.
Stun, too. So the stun helps in melee. You know, against the 4 attack operatives, you can actually stun out and actually still win while not taking too much damage.
Yeah, that gives her a little bit more survivability, especially if you have Epic active. It guarantees you the crit, so you can get an extra parry, and then if you have Jest, maybe you can get like two. Maybe you can stop 2 of those hits getting through. And she's got 9 wounds, so she's actually kind of tough to kill as well.
Mm-hmm. Then on In the Dark, you can definitely make a traffic jam, right? As people are getting ready to move through doors, if you stun someone, that can actually cause issues as far as activation order, which is nice.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, she has the stun grenade, which is, or the hallucination grenade, but it has a stun. It's effectively a stun grenade, and that's super useful against Gellipox. Because it has like a really huge, it's like a 2 inches from a point, so it's like it's effectively a 4-inch diameter bubble that you can.
And the big thing is on open, it's also one of those operatives that can chuck it at a point through a wall because it is not, that hasn't been changed.
She does get a minus if she can't see the person, but yes, it's cool. It also does a mortal wound on a 6, so. You know, if you're going for a Hail Mary, like play one wound guy you have to kill, you can do that as well. So that sometimes works. But yeah.
Okay. Actually, bringing up the point about the Death Jester being able to do a reap with Murderous Entrance is actually a really fun ploy that I had never really considered.
I'm always watching for it. It never happens, but it potentially it's there, right? You know, you might be able to just pick up 3 people in an activation with the shoot as well.
Yeah, and you can even do like, yeah, basically a charge fight shoot is definitely in the cards, so long as you're only doing a 6-inch charge. But depending on the boards, you know, because you have flying, a 6-inch charge does quite a bit on open boards. Like on Octarius, you know, you can jump from one side of a piece of Octarius to the other, even through a door block, slice a dude in half, and then just blast out a Shrieker cannon.
Yeah, I will say the Death Jester is a little bit tall. So if you ever have those, the crates, the terrain that they have on some of the boards, the Shuriken cannon kind of sticks out above that. Or some of the, I think the Chalnaff walls aren't quite high enough for the Death Jester to get obscured behind them. So he's kind of like, come shoot me, guys. You got to get, yeah, so you have to get back 2 inches away from those. Otherwise, you're not safe.
Have you ever used the Shrieker Toxin rounds? Or are you pretty much just, you've never bothered, you just take the support grip?
So I have thought about it one time because I played a game against Gellipox on TTS and they did the Plute stockpile on the grip. Mm-hmm. So the grip now costs 2. So I was sort of thinking, well, now I can only take basically 2 other pieces of equipment. It would be 2 more after the grip. Or not take the grip and then take the Shrieker Toxins for 4 and then 2 other pieces for 3 each. And I sort of thought, well, the Death Jester doesn't need to move that much in this game. They can just sit and dash and shoot with the Shrieker Toxins. In the end, I kind of chickened out and took the grip anyway, but I did think about it for a moment. Yeah.
Okay, so between the two, you prefer the Shadow Seer, at least for the way you play. You've got more tricks, and the Death Jester you're generally just using to do the long-range shooting, making sure your opponent respects the Shrieker Harvest, or Shrieking Harvest, the Torrent, and the Torrent Shot.
Yeah, pretty much. Death Jester is nice to have, obviously, because it does give you some long range. It forces your opponent to put people on concealed. But yeah, I think the Shadow Seer is by far my favorite operative of the two. So yeah, I give it to the Shadow Seer.
Oh, cool. As far as the debate on who's picking up the special weapons, where do you generally fall?
Oh, geez. Okay, so, like, there isn't really a lot of choice on how you sort of... I mean, there actually, with the weapons there is, but if you go to the Harlequins Discord channel, not channel, but the thread on the Command Point Discord,
mm-hmm.
this conversation just repeats itself again and again.
We're just looking for your personal opinion. Obviously, there's what everybody says on the internet, and then there's what people who actually play decide they like over time. I know locally, one of my players, he likes having his leader guaranteed to do something, so sometimes he puts the weapon there. And then in some matches where you want a little bit more ability to like spread out which operators are important, then he'll put the special guns on the players. So it just depends. But where do you fall?
Yeah, so... I like that. There's certainly like if you had the freedom, like it would be lovely to have the option of either taking the shuriken or maybe the neurodestructor on the leader. But I always give them the fusion pistol, and I guess I have two reasons for this. The first reason is really that it takes up too much space on the roster to give them the other pistol options. And I think you need all of those 20 slots if you want like a take all comers list that you were submitting to a tournament. You can't really afford to give up those spaces. It is nice to be able to put the fusion pistol on a player if you're up against like a guard team who you can just reliably kill with just a 3-up rather than the 2-up. But I think because of how effective it is against Marines, you pretty much have to take it. You have to have the option of taking the fusion pistol on the leader. Also, the second reason is that my Troop Master model has the fusion pistol on it, and I love that model, and I'm just always going to use it, so that's what I do.
Nothing wrong with rule of cool.
No. Yeah. Like I said, also, like with the roster size, I think you want to have, you need those other 17 spaces. You know, you have the Death Jester, the Shadow Seer, and the leader, and then you have 17 other slots, and I think you need them all for the different weapon options. So, you know, there's gameplay reasons for doing that.
Yeah, and that ties in really well with the different weapon options is one of the other comparisons that we wanted to chat about. Just a quick recap on what they are and when you would use each one.
Okay, so you have basically the same profile in three of them, the 4-5 damage, but then they have a different keyword. So the embrace gives you brutal, so you can't be parried, and then the blade gives you the reroll for the balanced, and then the crest gives you rending, which is kind of nice. The kiss doesn't have any special keywords, but it does have a 3-7 profile instead of the 4-5. And I guess, like I said, there's a use case for all of them. I have like a huge list of when I take each one. And let me just look at that. So, yeah, like some of the advice you see people give is they say, oh, like if you're against a 7-wound team, you take the kisses. And otherwise you take blades. But I think it's kind of the other way around, honestly. I think there are situations, maybe against novitiates, where you take the kisses. Against the 7-wounded operatives, but I think the kisses are really good into commandos or like any kind of 10-wound team. They're good against Hunter Clade because they have 7 and 10, so it's a really nice profile into them. I think you take the kisses against Hand of the Archon because you want to be able to see how much damage you're doing. You want to front load your damage against Hand of the Archon because they got that 6-up Feel No Pain, and you're also, if you didn't roll a crit against Hand of the Archon when you charge them, you're not killing them because they're going to make 1-6 out of the 8 that you do. So you have to roll sixes anyway, so you may as well have a kiss and do those 7 damage first, see how the Feel No Pains go, and then you can decide, okay, am I going to play one of my ploys, right? Am I going to double hit them or am I going to fall back? And then the blades, I think you take blades against Tau. Like, they've all got 7 wounds, but I think they're so bad in combat that it doesn't matter, right? They're just going to hit once, right? You'll parry it, and then... Or you can double hit them if they got a couple more crits or whatever, and they got lucky with their rolls. But you don't need to do kisses against them. And also, you got to play tragedy. You need the protection from their shooting. So against, like, guard teams, like Blooded, or maybe Vet Guard... or you want to have the tragedy state F up, so you're getting your protection from being shot, and that means you're not going to get guaranteed crits. And yeah, that's why you should go blades against those 7-wing teams. And okay, I can go on about this if you like.
No, this is good. I think this is good. It's nice to hear different opinions. I'm sure that the people who are Harlequin diehards who listen to the podcast will comment on our Discord and tell us what we got wrong in today's podcast. But for now, the floor is all yours, because neither me or Jason is playing Void Dancers actively.
Okay, so I'll go for a little bit more. I'll just touch on some of the other weapons. So the Caress. You take that against Void Dancers because in the mirror match, because they obviously have Jest, so they could parry non-crits. So getting two crits means you've got enough to kill them, and they can't really do anything about it. You also take one or two against Ginstealer Cult, because the Locust gets that parry before they hit, and they could parry one of your crits, which means you couldn't kill them with Murderous Entrance, but if you had two crits, you totally can. And it's kind of the same reason you take them against Warp Coven, because the Caress is the only weapon that could reliably kill the sorcerer that had the arcane ropes, right? So they have 13 wounds, but they will ignore one of your crits, so you need two. And that would allow you to... You have like a 30% chance of killing a sorcerer, or a 50% chance if you spend a CP for a reroll, which is not bad odds against a sorcerer from a player. And then... can you roll a crit? Kind of says this, and I agree. You should take the upgraded kiss against intercession. You should also take the kiss against breaches and Nurgle legionary, because they have the damage reduction, which doesn't do anything to the free damage, right? But you keep the high damage on the crits. And you should take it, against breaches. And okay, so the embrace. I put two embraces on the roster, because those are good against Exaction. So, like, if the Exaction player has the shield dudes who have the double parries, they could only
parries and no rerolls.
Exactly, right. So you don't want the blades anyway. They're no use here. And the brutal means that they can't parry you unless they rolled a crit. So they can't use their double parry most of the time, which is really nice, which means you can kind of kill those guys. Most of the weapons don't work. This is the reason why I don't take extra weapons options on the leader, because I need room for the embraces, more or less. So yeah, I'll stop here.
Yeah, that was all really good insight. Like, I think like someone that hasn't played Void Dancer as much as you would come to different conclusions, but you kind of just like pierced right through it and were like, here's a better choice and here's why. I really enjoyed that, so thank you for that.
I think just being able to have different perspectives on what is good and what is not is important, especially when people are just looking at Discord a lot of the time and seeing ad infinitum arguments. But at the end of the day, it's up to players to pick their playstyle. So calling out that sometimes you want the embrace and when you want it, I think that's good. But, you know, that's probably not speaking about how your impact has been on the community, because, you know, there's got to be other teams that are being played. It sounds like you've been doing pretty well, if you were wondering why there weren't a ton of Void Dancers floating around at the World Championships. So tell us a little bit about your local meta.
So we have kind of a very sort of mixed community here. So a lot of different teams. Some people like David and one of our other players, Austin, just have so many different teams. So you never know who they're going to play with. I think David might have all the teams, but he doesn't have Void Dancers. He hates them, so I don't think he has that team. But Austin has all the teams, I think. And then we have a bunch of people who like Intercession. Some people like Phobos. There's a few other Corsairs players. Some really nice, some really, really nicely painted miniatures and on some, with some of the teams here. Like some really talented hobbyists. And so recently, I guess, people have dabbled with Felgors and cults, but they haven't been that popular. I think people generally like to play with their teams. There are a couple of commandos players, although again, I haven't seen the sort of the triple sneaky git plays that, you know, people have been talking about online. So we don't generally, we're not like in the bleeding edge of the meta here. We just, people like to play their favorite teams and drink a couple of beers while they're doing it, right? So it's a little bit more casual here, I guess.
you know, thinking of that, are there any plans for you and David to kind of ramp up a little bit more of the competitive scene? Because I'm sure next year for 2024, if a Japanese player came out with a golden ticket, I'm sure GW would be extremely happy with that. So have you guys been planning to maybe have more serious tournaments coming up?
I think the community as a whole would quite like that. I think that we kind of missed the boat this year for getting in on the ticket system that GW have. And maybe, like, I don't know how that works, honestly. Like, do you guys have, like, any insight in how the sort of the golden ticket system works? You need to be, like, an official event with GW or...
You do not need to be an official event with GW. Being a tournament organizer is good enough. You just have to reach out, have an event ready, and have a location, at least for 2023. Maybe 2024 will be different. So obviously I got one for the New York Open, and I'm hoping to get one again next year. And there's going to be other events that have golden tickets. So if I see anything, I'll make sure that, you know, I'll spread it out to the TOs who listen, just so that everyone knows. And hopefully Japan, you guys can get a person in too.
Yeah, we would super like that, honestly. So yeah, we do want to expand the team, the scene here. We are, like, through the Discord, like, we're just getting everyday new people coming in. And it's the War Gamers in Japan Discord. So it's like, they're not just Kill Team players, but obviously we can get them into Kill Team through that, that way as well. And yeah, so we're really trying to build up the scene, and we're a little bit restricted with the size of the venues that we got at the moment. It's a little bit trickier to get large venues. We have been organizing like a couple of 40k events recently since the launch at 10th, and those have been super popular. They just sell out within a few minutes of going up. And so we're really capped at the capacity of, like, I say, like, we had one at 24 and then another one at 32. At like a community center, but those are kind of like, it's hard to reserve those places sometimes, so yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into getting those places. And also, like, the Kill Team terrain is a bit of an issue, so maybe I'll tell you a little bit about sort of the sort of boards that we play on, because they're kind of unique, right? So when we started playing at this gaming club, David basically made scratch built all of this terrain from, like, if you know Daiso, it's like a 100 yen store, like a one coin, like a dollar store, I guess, would be equivalent, right? And they have like this sort of terrain that's kind of catered towards like the Japanese gunpla scene, right? It's but you can have like these little miniature houses, and he basically took those and sprayed them and stuck like imperial propaganda posters on them and made them look just great. So we have like a kind of like, it's kind of like our own specific terrain setup, and it's interesting. We have scramble piles, we have like smaller buildings than Octarius, and we have like chimneys and stuff, and it's kind of cool. It's a really kind of unique terrain setup that we've got here, and we've been sort of playing around with trying to. We're kind of like, we don't like alpha strikes, right? So we generally try to set up so that we have enough heavy in the deployment zones, but also enough sort of places you can move forward up the board. It's hard to get the balance right. I don't know. Have you guys found any sort of things that worked for terrain setups and things? Like, what sort of terrain do you guys use?
You know, at the New York Open, we use a mix of all the different GW kits along with just MDF terrain. So there's a pretty hodgepodge mix in New York. Mostly because I was bootstrapping off of an existing 40k community. So I borrow terrain from a local shop, and then people donate terrain from the community, and then we give them back at the end of the open. But generally, I try to make sure the mid board has some areas that are a little bit more dense, and then some objectives that are a little bit less dense. That way there's a little bit of push and pull on where to go, what's safe, and where you can actually play. And then for deployments, I like having some parts that are unsafe and some parts that are more safe, but I will not generally put the safest parts at the edge of the deployment line, mostly because when you get to diagonal boards and the 6-inch deployment short board, like the long boards, you're losing a lot of play space if you're just putting everything inside the box of deployment. That way you have places that are a little bit more dangerous and places that are a little bit less dangerous, and objectives that are like, you gotta move dash, so you're not just like only taking aggressive actions. And I found that to be a nice balance, but obviously different regions have different play styles. I think Ryan Slater from Turning Point Tactics, all of his boards have everything inside the play box and a lot of heavy mid boards, but it really just depends. I don't know how Jason has been doing stuff recently.
Yeah, we were sourcing stuff from the community. So like Octarius and Into the Dark were really common. So we kind of tried to like muster a lot of that for Into the Dark just so that we could have something uniform and we could have like a bunch of tables that were pretty standard, pretty similar. We had a couple of mismatched ones just because we like Into the Dark, we actually had like the most of, and then it was Octarius and then some kind of like hodgepodge stuff that we set up, which was great. Like the mismatched boards turned out really well, in my opinion as well. But we actually started up a little discussion in our local Discord talking about for next year, starting to develop our own boards. So then it would be like, we would 3D print a bunch of terrain and then just like make it ahead of time and then come up with layouts for missions that's like fixed and like set and ready to go. And then we could just have a bunch of boards with 3D printed terrain that we can have the same exact thing and just kind of like our homemade system here. So that's in pretty like early development. Yeah, we'll see where it goes.
So I there was a couple of things I was kind of hoping to ask you guys about was did you guys see the LVO tournament packet? I think it was just put out recently, and they obviously have their own terrain setup, right? The sort of custom made terrain setups with terrain. I mean. Have you guys seen that? And like, did you think that's something like, it has like sort of like, almost independent, like wall sections, like an L shapes in the middle of the board. Have you guys seen those? And what did you think about it? Is it something that would be good to incorporate?
Yeah, I went to LVO last year. And I didn't really know what to expect. And like someone made maps for it on TTS that I practiced, but like the actual boards in person were different enough that it was like it wasn't exactly like captured by TTS. And then the actual boards in person I actually liked a lot. Dakota, who actually on that note real quick, Dakota who makes that terrain also made a Just Another Kill Team gauge, so listeners, if you would like to order one of those, you're absolutely welcome to do so. It's the little measuring stick. It has a 6, a 2, and a 3 and a 1 inch thing all on one device, and it has the Just Another Kill Team podcast logo on it, and we'll throw a link to that in there as well. But yeah, Dakota's made a lot of really good terrain. I got a preview of the Into the Dark boards that Luster's Workshop Dakota made as well, and it was really cool. I haven't looked at the tournament pack yet. Are they doing Into the Dark at LVO at all this year?
Yeah, Dakota has his own like new In the Dark terrain setups along with all of his older MDF terrain that he's modified from with feedback from the community over the last year. So I think it is a pretty large departure from what it was last year as far as the actual event. So it'll be In the Dark that are brand new maps because they're Dakota's maps, and then there's new open maps. Personally, for me in Brooklyn, we have a set of Dakota's MDF terrain that I painted, and it works pretty well. I think it's a little bit too dense out of the box, and I think he's taken that to heart, and he's actually loosened up how much heavy there is spread out across the board. When I design maps, I also put just some pieces of basically heavy terrain that kind of just block visibility, but aren't humongous footprints, because I find that having some of those inside of like the back part of the deployment gives you a safe spot to deploy that isn't just like free movement. So I think it's pretty good. You can buy some. His turnaround times can take a while sometimes, but the terrain is pretty solid. It just takes a little bit of work to actually build because it's a lot of MDF gluing to do.
Yeah. I also do want to point out the set that I saw, like the demo set for the Into the Dark stuff, is really cool. One of the things that I especially liked is like at the tournament tables, if you've got a bunch of tables together and it's not easy to like walk around to get an angle on the other side, he's got a solution to that where he's got little windows in the walls and like the doors and stuff. So like if you just are like standing at a fixed spot and like you can't really move around, you can see through the little windows and know that there's an operative on the other side of a wall. I just thought that was really clever, and like it looks great, and it was really cool.
Yeah, no, those sound real good. With the The Into the Dark layouts you're talking about, some of those were asymmetrical, right?
Correct. He has his own like brand new thing. I saw him test it out like in the middle of the year in LA, and some of those terrain setups I didn't love, but I think the newer ones, for the most part, the ones that I've seen, I've liked. And we even tried a couple of them at the New York Open just to mess with people. And yeah. People, for the most part, have liked playing asymmetric in the dark, especially after a full year of playing more or less the same map layouts.
Yeah, I think we have an event coming up on Sunday, and we're going to try, I think, to run these asymmetrical layouts. So we're kind of looking forward to that, because like you say, it makes the attack and defender role actually matter, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a very common thing at the World Championships where you just pick attacker all the time, because why would you not?
Yeah, completely.
So you guys have about 20 players, growing more day by day. There's obviously a reasonably large 40K community that you're hoping to borrow players from over time. What other, you know, who else in the community has really helped push the community forward? Obviously, David is a big part of the Japanese 40K community, from what I can tell. But who else is the you know, leaders outside of you?
So I guess I'd have to mention Austin, who's actually really active on. He's been really active on TTS and has a YouTube channel. He has Austin Powers. Yeah, and he has a sort of a video that explains how to use TTS for Kill Team, which has been super useful for a lot of people. And he's been real good for having demo games with people. We also have people who the store managers. Yuka and Harajuku and Daniel and Yokohama, they've been real good with getting people to play demo games in the stores and helping them to sort of come into the community that way. And I guess I should also mention the official best player in our community is Tom, so he's been real good as well for sort of, you know, just, you know, being part of the community and getting people into the hobby as well. And yeah, I could go through the list of all the people, but I guess it would take too long. So,
Do you guys have a favorite dinner or lunch spot that you guys, I know you mentioned pizza, but do you guys ever do sushi or any other more Japanese options?
So there, well, I guess the Izukiya that we go to afterwards for the typical sort of Japanese pub we go to is nice. There is a, and again, it's not really Japanese, but there's a really nice American barbecue place not far away, which is so good, honestly. So we go there occasionally as well. We save that one for special occasions, though.
So Yokohama, Akihabara, you've got tournaments coming up. You're going to one, you know, by the time this podcast comes out, it'll be past. But I think you mentioned it was going to be an all in the dark tournament.
Yeah, so we've been playing mostly open for a long time now, because we found Into the Dark a little bit tricky to play because it was very swingy, right? Some of the maps can kind of like, you know, you sort of separate the sort of thing, teams in the sort of map into lanes, and if you win one lane, you kind of just win the game sometimes, especially if you have like recon tac ops like Korea or something like that. You can kind of just get all your tac ops, and it's kind of it wasn't as interactive, we felt, but we're going to try more Into the Dark maps, and hopefully these asymmetrical maps will be kind of cool, and we'll be able to get sort of you know, and people have made some really nice Into the Dark terrains. Like they've like magnetize the sections, so you don't have to slot them together. I think David did that with his. It's it makes things so much easier, honestly. So yeah,
the labor of love to magnetize an entire set in the dark.
No, totally. I don't know how many sets you guys have to deal with for a tournament if you're doing all Into the Dark for like, I know, 30 players. It must be a real task.
I've gotten very good at breaking down and setting up in the dark boards, but you kind of get used to it over time. And especially, you know, for any TOs or people who setting up in the dark sets, I would always like organize your pieces first and then build starting from like the B3 walls, and then never cap anything until you've seen all the pieces in the correct spot. then put on caps at the end, and it saves a world of trouble.
No, definitely.
And Jason's even got some extra tips as far as painting goes. He's got little like paint spots underneath each of the caps so that you make sure you know if you're doing a flat or a corner, basically, right, Jason?
Yeah. So like all of the like triangle piece corners that connect, if you take a moment to line them all up. So like I'll also start with the B3 doors there, and then set up all the B3 doors like in the same orientation, and then I'll take all of the other corners and then set them up in the same orientation. So then all of them are either like triangle A or triangle B. And if you put two A's together, it makes a straight line through. And if you put two B's together, it's a straight line through. And if you put an A and a B together, it gives you a 90 degree angle. So then you paint all of the A's red and all of the B's blue. And then just at a glance, you've got this color-coded system. And then when you put it all together, you put the caps on it, and then it covers up your little color-coded thing. So you like, you don't even see it. And it's super practical, super helpful, highly recommended.
Wow. That sounds genius, honestly. Because we this is part of the reason, because we have a sort of a short period of time. We have like 2-hour rounds, and then we have just enough time for 4 rounds. So setting up and making new maps with the Into the Dark terrain, it just took too long, right? So having this sort of system would be really cool. I think.
My big thing for any, you know, aspiring TOs is just don't change maps in between rounds. It's too much work, and it'll just drive you insane. Like just make enough boards for everyone to play, and then just rotate everyone through. So I just would never, I would never say change a board midway through a tournament, basically.
Yeah, I think this is what we might do on Sunday. We're going to rotate across a few different boards with different layouts. Yeah.
You don't really gain that much from standardizing what everyone is playing on. All you gain is more headaches as a TO. So definitely just run a whole bunch of different boards and just make your life easier.
Yeah, totally. Cool. Thanks for the advice. Appreciate that one.
Yeah, no worries. So you've got Discord, Line, got players everywhere, scenes growing, tournaments coming up, but you know, as far as talking about individual operatives, I don't think that's enough, right, Jason?
Niche tactics.
We haven't even touched on the niche tactics yet, so the niche tactics once again is going to be Void Dancer Troop, obviously, but this time for niche tactics, instead of like comparing operatives, we're jumping right into like clever plays. So this is more of like synergies and combos. I'm sure you kind of touched a little bit on some of the cool combos with the Shadow Seer especially, and I'm sure that there's more in that, or just like take those plays and break it down a little bit more with maybe like throw in a little more context of like scenarios and real examples. And then just kind of like anything in general that you want to throw down for the niche tactics, the floor is yours.
So with the Shadow Seer, I guess I got a couple I can talk about. With the Shadow Seer, the something I like to if I'm playing Vantage or Recover Item, and this is actually going to lead into the next one, is you can sort of play the sort of Do Not Charge Outside of 6, which also gives you cover as well. And because most Vantage points don't have cover on them, you're generally just going to get shot if you're up there. But if you could charge someone into combat, and then you're going to use Curtain Falls to fall back, you can get quite a large movement up onto a vantage point. And then because if you have Domino Field active and you didn't shoot, you haven't broken Domino Field, they can't really get within 6 of you because you're up on a vantage quite easily. So you can just sit there for the rest of the turning point, and you can't be shot and you can't be charged. And you're reasonably safe and you'll score vantage that way. And also you got to hit somebody. And this kind of sort of connects to the other thing I wanted to talk about with Curtain Falls. So we had a ruling, I think, in the FAQs of the World Championships beforehand. Even though nobody was playing Void Dancers, they still put this in there, which is kind of interesting.
It's there because of a New York thing. Like, there is a specific subset of players that I will not name on this podcast where the question was asked to get this ruling just so that we could settle a discussion thing in New York. So yeah, that's why it's there. You know, there are definitely no Void Dancer players at the World Championships, and it was definitely kind of just to clarify something that basically remains relatively foggy as far as the actual Raw is concerned.
Yeah, and it was really surprising, the ruling that they made on that, because it was the question was like, if you kill somebody, so if you strike and kill an operative and incapacitate them, could you then use curtain falls to fall back? And would you be able to fall back? And for a long time, it seemed super obvious to me that, like, this guy's dead. You can attempt the fallback move, but you're not committed to it legally because the person's been removed from the board. But in the FAQ, they said, these two things happen simultaneously, and the player with the initiative decides the order, which is really random. So, like, if you win the initiative at the start of the turning point, you can charge into somebody, kill them, and then you get to fall back, which is really powerful, because you can just save your operative from being shot, you can tuck him around a corner. So the utility with that is really good, but it's kind of random because you needed the initiative, right? So
I will say, for anyone listening to this podcast or anyone that has taken that ruling as kind of like an FAQ, I would not. Being at the World Championship and having talked to a couple of the people there, it was definitely a ruling just for that tournament. And hopefully it'll be clarified in an FAQ or something soon. But yeah, as far as the TO was concerned, the rules tie and the rest of the surrounding rule base is not quite clear enough to say what happens between immediately and when a model is reduced to zero wounds, because there's not a version of kind of a like a state-based action in Magic where anytime something is fulfilled, you do a bunch of busy work to make sure the game is stable. And Kill Team technically doesn't have that yet, so that's why that ruling was made. So if it were me and it were ruled at one of my tournaments, I would not do that at the moment, just because it is muddy enough where I would not take it. But obviously it is a big discussion point, because if you can, it is crazy, crazy powerful. So hopefully we'll have it resolved soon.
Yeah, I wish Kill Team had like the stack system that Magic has. It would make things so much easier to resolve, like sequencing things like this. But yeah,
to be fair, as far as like Kill Team goes, we're kind of like in the beta version of the game, and Magic has had, you know, 12 editions worth of changes. So hopefully Kill Team is stable enough where they'll just keep building on it, and we won't get a full rules wipe every 3 years like it does in 40K, just because our rule set is like much tighter.
Yeah, I will say I haven't used this yet, so I feel okay about that. But I would definitely like an official FAQ.
Yeah, definitely a case of I would ask my TO at the beginning of the tournament. You can bring up the FAQ, but at the end of the day, I wouldn't push it too hard, because it really is muddy enough where from the World Championship itself, it was muddy to everyone. So I wouldn't hold the world to what the ruling would be for that tournament.
Yeah. And then I guess just one last thing on Curtain Falls. If you're playing Capture and your opponent has left their back objective open, or maybe they just left someone with two APL on it, and they think like, oh, this is completely safe, you can't reach it. Well, you can basically jump on somebody's head with Curtain Falls and get like a 14-inch move, which is kind of crazy. So you could basically charge somebody, take control of that objective away from them because you've got three APL, hit them once, fall back another 6 inches onto another objective, and now you take that control away from them. And you could do this at the end of the turning point, and then you, oh, as your last activation, and then you get Overwatch into that person that you're right next to. So this person that they thought was completely safe, maybe their leader and you picked Headhunter, and now your leader is just going to fusion pistol them on Overwatch, and there's nothing they can do about it because you just moved them 14 inches. It's you can catch people out with that one. It's kind of nice.
Okay, I want to throw an idea on there. The same thing, but with assassinate target.
Yes, no, completely. Because yeah, they'll lead that person way back, right? I didn't think about assassinate target, but that's cool. Thank you. I'm gonna try that one now.
Yeah, I feel like that'd be some real nonsense. That's kind of like the same thing that I was doing with Legionary. I was playing all Khorne, and then with Perpetual Aggression, every time you kill someone in melee, you can make a 3-inch move, and you can use that to charge into someone else. So like you kind of just like chain lightning nestle into people, and if you kill someone and then move 3 inches, like all just the ridiculous speed from that is really good for assassinate target. And I feel like what you explained is pretty much just like the same kind of power.
Yeah, I am terrified when I play against Khorne. It's because they can just one shot me. They get there with the plus one damage.
Khorne Legionaries, they both one shot you, and there's nothing you could do about it because you can't parry the free crit from Khorne.
Exactly. Yeah, it's quite scary. It's a fun game though. I like playing as legionaries generally. But yeah, I'll be watching out for that one.
How do you generally approach the Sadeth options? Because I know there's a lot of like tricky things that you can do with Sadeth. Obviously, you called out earlier when you're playing against Tau, you really want Tragedy to have the defensive buff. Are there any other crazy Sadeth picks that you take against specific opponents?
Generally, if my opponent has grenades and they out-activate me, or they have some way of just getting a shot on me on the first turning point, I'll start with Tragedy because you're just going to get some free points, at least, from being shot. And it's also nice because it gives you, like even if you're against Guard or Tau, and you probably want to stay on Tragedy the whole game, you do have the option of switching, right? So sometimes people say, oh, like you should start with Melodrama, get a few points from your Death Jester, and then switch. But I like having the ability to somehow switch. And like Odyssey gives you +1 to charge, which if you've got the initiative at the start of a turning point and they thought they were safe more than 9 inches away from you, sometimes now you can switch to Odyssey and you can make that charge. So that's situationally really useful. I haven't ever found a use for comedy, which is the one where you fall back for one less AP. That's, I think, the most useless Sadeth by a long, long way. But the others are all useful. I think you take Melodrama, the shooting one. Probably you take it against Cults because you kind of want to be shooting them a lot. And maybe Gellipox as well. Although, again, you can switch into Epic if you need to. I guess the sort of typical way to do it is to start with Tragedy and then switch into Epic as soon as you can get team-wide crits on the charge. I think that's generally what you're trying to do, and unless your team is a shooty team, in which case you just stay in Tragedy.
Yeah, maybe comedy might have some play against RBDs because RBDs are trying to use the shields and you can run into them and then fall back later, but that seems like a very niche use.
Yeah, generally you don't survive that long if you're in combat with someone, and they can shoot into combat, right? So they're just gonna There might be situations where you get the initiative and you want to fall back and do an action and shoot someone, and then maybe you do it. But yeah, I've yet to have that ever happen. So
yeah, I was going to say I did the mobile chapter tactic for Intercessors, and that's fallback for one APL. And then that's like a fun thing to do with a grenade, for example. If you just like run up and you tag people, and then on the next turn you can fall back, capture a point, and throw a grenade at someone is a good use for that. Or like if you're Death Jester, I guess you still, it's heavy, so you couldn't fall back and shoot anyways. For one of your gunners, you could fall back, dash, and shoot someone that's really far away. Or like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's not as strong as the rest, but I've noodled around with a similar concept for Intercessors, and I've had a lot of fun and had some like unpredictable, kind of like ridiculous plays come up, and it's kind of something to think about.
I guess it's, yeah, if you're charging and not fighting and you're blocking people, yeah, I can see it being kind of good there, right? I think, so there is a strat, a tactical ploy, that if you fall back from someone and shoot them or shoot someone else, you can reroll all of your dice, which if you charge with the Death Jester, say they didn't have a shot, and then you switch to comedy, then fall back for one AP, and then you did this strat, you could then reroll all your dice, right? So you get relentless. So I can see that working. That would actually be kind of cool.
You could get potentially a comedic Ruthless Derision Shrieking Harvest and just pop up behind someone and just nuke an entire board corner with relentless. That could be a play.
Yeah, fall back.
I don't know if it would come up all that often, but it definitely sounds like it could be devastating.
Yeah. I mean, just all it takes is do it once. But the question is the Shrieker cannon heavy?
It is. So when you get cumbersome, you can move up to 6 inches in a move. So you can fall back as long as you move only 6 inches, then you can go ahead and fire it away.
Yeah, so it replaces heavy with cumbersome.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because the heavy keyword is like you can, if you move or fall back, you can't shoot.
Yeah.
Like all together.
So you can definitely do that entire line. You can Shrieking Harvest and then let loose with 5 attacks on 3s, 4, 5. rending relentless on Torrent 2. And, you know, maybe you just win the game on the spot against some of the Horde teams that way.
I think we just, especially if you, like, people are like, that's not at all what you expect from a Death Jester. So if he just, like, rips it down the middle of the board, tags someone, and then does a very unpredictable, just, like, Torrent murder fest, would that reroll thing apply to every single one of the shots in the Torrent?
Have you fallen back?
It might just be one shot after you've rolled the dice, but I'd have to check it.
Shooting attack?
I think so, yeah. But it's still good. And if you're into the dark and you're doing Torrent, that's lethal 5 up, so that's a lot of crits.
Yeah, either way, that's very strong.
Yeah, and the way you would line this up is, you know, you're playing against a Horde team, they move up a dude onto one of the frontline objectives. Your Death Jester is already on engage, and he just charges instead of doing a shot, and your opponent looks confused, and then the start of the next turn, you flip the script, pop comedy, which, you know, no one is going to expect, and then fall back with your Death Jester and just nuke someone.
Truly a comical effect.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is probably a spot where it could be useful. Maybe, you know, in the dark especially, because there's a lot of midboard points where everyone is kind of like doinking around. So if you can get an early charge with a recon dash, it would definitely throw people's plans really, really far out of whack.
And like,
you might be trapped on comedy though, which might not be the best.
That's true. But like, if you really just like planned for it, I'm sure, like, if you plan for that, you can 100% make an amazing play out of that. And then if you know you're going to be trapped in comedy, and it's like, you know what, I'm just going to like tag people all the time and fall back and do ridiculous shenanigans that everyone's going to hate, then we're just going to laugh it off and hit them with the blasters.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there are some teams I definitely want to be tagging rather than killing, right? So yeah, I'll, if I get it to work on Sunday, I'll give you guys a message.
Yeah, post it in the Discord for sure. How about any other big plays that you like doing, or things that maybe you don't see talked about quite as much on you know, on the internet?
We have not the biggest set of abilities, I guess, with the team. I mean, the usual one, I guess, is the free APL charge, fight, shoot. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool. Off the top of my head, I guess it's just making sure that you can get overwatches, I suppose, and setting up so that your Death Jester can shoot multiple targets. So sometimes you can get, like if you're prepared to tank a shot, maybe you've got Tragedy up against a shooting team, and your opponent doesn't think you're going to double shoot with the Torrent profile and Death Jester, because it would be, they maybe tempt you into doing it, but you can like say, okay, I'm going to Torrent these two people, but also line a shot up and they'll do this last activation, so I can maybe hopefully take out three people with my Death Jester. That's something that I've had work a couple of times, but it's a gamble because obviously you're going to take a shot back. But getting that auto cover save from Tragedy is kind of nice. So yeah, and then I think the Shadowseer with the Mortal Wound power is also kind of nice for just chipping down damage, and sometimes you can kill, you know, she can double kill quite easily from someone else, like way over the other side of the board, and you know, after charging, it's kind of nice as well. But yeah.
I mean, it sounds like there's, those sounds like some niche plays, right, Jason?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been like an absolute gold mine where you've said a lot of things that I didn't expect that I absolutely loved. I was like, wow, it's very clear that you've been playing them a lot and that you've got a lot of experience with it. You've got like, that was really just like a treat.
Yeah, no, it's a fun team. Like, it's also like, I'm not the fastest player, so like not having to measure like around corners and stuff, and just everything being straight lines makes things so much easier. I think the team generally allows you to think a little bit more about your opponent's team and what their rules are, because you have that lower sort of cognitive of your team. You can start to think of like, what's my opponent doing? I have more time to think about that. While you're playing the team, and you can be, I think they're a bit more reactive perhaps than other kill teams, and I kind of like that style, I think.
Yeah, being able to respond to your opponents with novel strategies is part of what makes kill team, I think, a great game.
Yeah, totally. I think the, you know, you know, even if you played a matchup several times before, like, you'll always get into situations where, like, oh, now this operative is fighting against this operative, and, like, this hasn't happened before, right? Because there are so many unique operatives on a lot of the teams now that it does sort of create novel situations quite regularly, which is kind of cool, right?
Yeah, definitely one of my favorite parts, you know, at the World Championships, watching a Thug go into two different Tau operatives and then failing. I was like, well, I've never been in this position where my Shazla leader just stabs a Thug to death. I was like, this has never happened in my entire life.
The blooded combat operatives are scary, generally, right?
Except yeah, generally. Yeah. No, my poor French opponent, he came in with a Thug, spent all his CP to reroll three dice and missed all of them. So he got one hit. My Shazla, I think, between her three dice, got two crits and a hit, which wasn't enough to kill him because of the minus one damage. But the next turn, when she got to fight, she killed him.
Wow. Okay, I take back what I said about Tau being bad in combat.
Yeah, you know, they're bad until the random gun drone, like, doinks you for enough to kill.
Yeah, being killed by a gun drone is kind of, yeah. It's something that you have to take on.
I had a gun drone charge and kill someone, and a shield drone fall back and then lock up another two models in my World Championship run. So no, I didn't do particularly well, just because Pathfinder's not great right now in the meta, but having melee Tau is pretty funny.
How have you found, because you had games on Into the Dark, right?
Yeah, I played I played Blooded, Star Striders, and then two games against Commandos. Commandos on In the Dark basically feels almost impossible with the way the matchup is currently set up. It's not 100% impossible. I made mistakes that probably did cost me the game, but it's a rough matchup. Like, I can't make any mistakes. And then against Star Striders and Blooded, I felt like I had plenty of tools to play the game. So I think they're in a pretty good spot overall.
Yeah.
I quite like the play style, so I'm probably going to play them a little bit more in the 2024 year.
Did you find much use out of the Overwatch Marker Light thing?
Yeah, the Overwatch Marker Light thing is pretty solid. It does have the one downside of if your opponent charges you, you cannot Marker Light into combat, so it doesn't actually do anything there. So you do have to be very cognizant of the ranges that you're trying to set it up on. Yeah. But one of the cool things you can do against people is you can basically marker light, then go on guard, and then marker light again. So you can put someone in a room up to four marker lights. You do risk that you need to be able to see into the room, and you need to not move on the first turn. So there is a little bit of setup cost, but it does mean that on turn one, you can nuke people that go into the rooms pretty hard. So, yeah.
I will say I've been caught out by the blooded Pathfinder with his silent sort of suppressed railgun, right? Pulse rifle.
Yeah, there's two different silent profiles on the Pathfinder team. The blooded, who's like the experienced operative with the metal arm, and then the guy with the railgun that's, yeah, 3-5 silent, basically.
Yeah. Because, like, I look at the sort of Tau team and I think, oh, this is the combat guy, right? He's got the bionic arm, like, he's your melee guy, right? Oh, he's also got a really good silent gun. Like,
yes.
I've been caught out by that before, but never again. It's yeah.
The team does have all the tools to compete on In the Dark, just not particularly against Commandos. I think against Elites and a bunch of other stuff, they're still pretty good. So
yeah,
but, you know, talking about the 2024 calendar year, you know, we've got the UTC finals coming up on January 13th, 14th over here on the East Coast. There will be a cash prize from what I've been told. So whenever I get those links up, we'll make sure everyone can see it. And, you know, before we head out, Paul, any other final things before we split for the night?
Yeah, I think we covered a lot, so that's kind of cool. I said most of the stuff I was sort of wanting to talk about, so I think we're good, honestly. Yeah.
We'll try to make sure we have links in the show notes for everyone to be able to follow through, and if they want to go get a game in Tokyo, you know, you know where to go now. David and Paul out in Yokohama, right?
Yeah, that's where we're based. Yeah, we really appreciate that. Thanks so much, and thanks for having us on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, and thank you, listeners, for listening until the end.